The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I was speaking to you yesterday on the subject of the Adamic administration, and I said at the end that I would continue this for a very brief period this morning on the subject, the relevance of the Adamic administration. And we may subsume the observations under two captions, namely negative and positive. And capital A, negative, there are several observations here. First, the special prohibition of Eden does not apply to us now. It was restricted to the conditions and circumstances of Eden and has no relevance outside of these circumstances and conditions. The whole-souled obedience that the prohibition was intended to exemplify is our obligation, but not this way of discharging it. Then second, as individuals, we do not undergo probation in terms of the Adamic administration. So it is totally wrong to say that we are all Adam and sin as he did. His sin was unique in that it was from integrity he fell. We do not individually fall from integrity. Hence, to construe the probations that we undergo as individuals or even in our corporate responsibilities in terms of the Adamic probation fails to take account of the unique character of Adam's situation and relationships. Then a third observation, we cannot attain to life in terms of the Adamic institution. That possibility was once for all forfeited for Adam and posterity by the fall, and the Adamic institution had no redemptive provisions. Then, more positively, the relevance of the Adamic administration, more positively, capital B, several observations. In Adam, as representative head, we all stood the probation in him and failed in him. His sin was our sin, his fall our fall, by reason of the solidarity with him. Likewise, the fulfillment of the threat draws posterity within its scope. All who die, die in Adam, and in Adam all die. The threat, therefore, exercises its sanction with unrelenting severity until totally different provisions of redemptive grace intervene. Then second and positively, Christ's vicarious sin-bearing on behalf of the new humanity included the Adamic sin as well as all other sins, and that aspect should never be overlooked. I fear that in our thinking and in our preaching, very frequently, that aspect of Christ's sin-bearing is totally overlooked. Then third, the obedience Christ rendered fulfilled the obedience in which Adam failed, but it would not be correct to say that Christ's obedience was the same in content or demand. Christ was called upon to obey in radically different conditions and required to fulfill radically different demands. Christ was sin-bearer, and the climactic demand of his representative relation was to die. This was not true of Adam. Christ came to redeem, but Adam was not appointed for that purpose. So Christ rendered the whole soul totality obedience, in which Adam failed, but under totally different conditions and with incomparably greater demand. We are liable to regard the Adamic administration as abstract, unrelated to our situation and practical interest. And it is quite easy to understand how we should have a good deal of difficulty with this Adamic administration, especially when it is construed in terms of a covenant of works, which I do not regard personally as a proper designation or as a proper construction. But nevertheless, even on a more biblical construction of this administration, it is so far removed from us that it may seem to have little or no relevance. Now, if we are inclined to think so, if our thinking follows that pattern, it is because we do not have a biblically conditioned way of thinking. The Adamic institution is intensely relevant if our thought is regulated by the biblical revelation. We are sinners, and we come into the world as such. That situation demands explanation. It cannot stand as an empirical fact without explanation. It requires the question, why or how do we come into the world as sinners? Now, it is the Adamic administration, with all its implications for racial solidarity, that alone provides the answer. That is the biblical answer to the universality of sin and death. Furthermore, we need salvation. How does salvation come to bear upon our need? Racial solidarity in Adam is the pattern according to which salvation is wrought and applied. By Adam, sin, condemnation, death came to reign. By Christ, righteousness, justification, and life come to be operative. And a way of thinking that makes us aloof to solidarity with Adam makes us also aloof to the solidarity by which salvation comes to be. So the relevance of the Adamic administration to what is most basic on the one hand, and most necessary on the other in our human situation. With that, I finish that particular topic, the Adamic administration. Now, I come to the topic of this morning, and I have chosen as the topic for discussion this morning the subject of free agency. I call it free agency, and I think it should be called free agency advisedly. Now, in dealing with this topic, it is helpful to begin with human action and proceed from action to that which determines action. I follow that pattern because I think it serves the interest of simplicity and of a development that is understandable. And by this progression from action to what determines action, we may arrive at a more satisfactory analysis of what is involved in free agency, or as it has sometimes been called, natural liberty. In the matter of terminology, it is necessary at the outset to to distinguish between free agency and free will. Now, no necessary objection can be made to the term free will. A term denotes the concept understood by it, and a proper connotation can be given to the term free will. But frequently, that designation free will has been used to express that concept of the will whereby the will of man is regarded as autonomous and undetermined, and therefore capable of volition, good or bad, apart from any previous conditioning by our moral and religious character. So you can readily see that the expression free will very readily lends itself to a rather abstract conception of will, and also in usage has come to designate a viewpoint of the will in abstraction from the whole person, which is quite alien to the teaching of Scripture. So, beginning with action, I have first of all this caption, "The Reality of Human Action." And the thought expressed here is simply that man is endowed with power to perform certain actions within the realm of his created and dependent existence. In other words, man's agency is not illusory. Within the all-embracing providence of God, he is possessed of agency, which is exercised or registered in action. Action of which he is the agent. Now, second, we have the responsibility of human action. Man's acts are worthy of blame or approval. Moral law, the law of obligation, applies to him. His acts are always within the sphere of ought and or ought not. That obtains because he is made in the image of God, and his actions must be in conformity with the likeness that defines his identity. That, I take it, is the fundamental principle in the analysis of human responsibility. God's likeness is the pattern in accordance with which man's action is to be performed. And the law that prescribes action or forbids it is simply the transcript of God's perfection, the perfection of God coming to expression for the regulation of conduct consonant with that perfection. Now, third, the freedom of human action. Not only the reality of human action, the responsibility of human action, but also the freedom. Responsibility, but the freedom. The responsibility I have just referred to rests upon the fact that the action, and now focusing attention simply upon action, is the result of a volition. Man wills or chooses to act. If he did not will to act, or if the act was contrary to his will, then the event occurring through his instrumentality is not in reality his action. In that case, he is the victim of some other power or agent over which he is not able to exercise control, and so he is not responsible for the event. We sometimes use the expression, "I did it against my will." I suppose we often use that or something synonymous with it. "I did it against my will." Well, that is not psychologically correct. We may do things reluctantly. We do things we detest. But if we do these things, it is because we willed to do them. Because we willed to do them. Because we chose to do them. We will to do the distasteful, in some instances, rather than not to do it. Something may be done against our will, and as I indicated, strictly speaking, we are not the agents. But when we do something, it is always because we willed to do it. We are responsible then for our acts because they are the result of our volition. And volition is the choice thus to act. Now, four, we have the determinant of volition. Responsibility leads us to volition. Now, the determinant of volition. It is, of course, a platitude to say that we will because we have the power to will. Because the power of volition does not explain why we exercise this power in a certain way. Two men have the power, for example, to earn a livelihood. One does it by honorable labor, the other resorts to theft. Now, what explains the difference? It is not the power of volition, for both are endowed with that quality. So we must go beyond the power of volition and the mere exercise of this power in actual volition. And that which lies back of the power and its exercise is the character. And because there is a radical difference of character, volition is exercised in totally different ways. Now, the character is what has sometimes been called the habitus. That is habit, not in our use of that word now, but as it originally meant. The character is the habitus of the person. The whole complex of desires, of motives, propensions, principles, and aims. And that may very conveniently be called the dispositional complex. And the complex comprises all that goes to make up the distinguishing moral and religious bent, aim, purpose, and propension of a particular person. Now, Scripture calls that dispositional complex the heart. Out of the heart are the issues of life. And our Lord is very express in this connection, quoting, "Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good man, out of the good treasure of his heart sends forth good things, and the evil man out of the evil treasure sends forth evil things." And again, "For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries," and so on. The Scripture throughout is replete with that emphasis upon the heart as the fountain of both good and evil. So volition is determined by the inward disposition, determined by the heart. Dr. Shedd, who has written very ably on this whole subject of free agency, calls the one immanent volition and the other executive volition. But whatever terms are used, the upshot is that much more belongs to man than his metaphysical constitution on the one hand and the series of volitions on the other. And it is that which comes in between that is the determinant of the moral and religious character of his actions and course of life. Now, five, we have the self-determination of volition and action. The self-determination of volition and action. If volition is determined by the dispositional complex, we have to ask this question: in what does freedom or natural liberty consist? We are not free because the will or power of volition is in a state of indifference or indeterminacy. It is not an autonomous power or agent that can register any series of volitions by virtue of its own unconditioned prerogative. Volition is causally determined, as we noted, by what the person most characteristically is. And therefore, the freedom or natural liberty consists in the fact that the series of volitions are determined by the self, determined by the person himself or herself. That is self-determined in the sense relevant to our topic. Action is self-action. Volition is self-volition, determined by what the person is, and not by any compulsion or coercion extraneous to the person himself or herself. The Westminster Confession of Faith has defined this with very remarkable precision when it says, chapter 9, section 1, God hath endued the will of man with that natural liberty that it is neither forced nor by any absolute necessity of nature determined to good or evil. And in the scripture, James 1:13-14 enunciates that description of the process of human action. Every man, it says, is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed, when he is allured by his own lust and enticed. That principle applies to all human situations in good and evil. It holds true in the fall and in regeneration. In the fall, man's disposition changed, and that resulted in the overt act of transgression. In regeneration, a new disposition is given, a new heart, and new volitions are the result. In no case is the volition contrary to the immanent disposition of heart and mind. When Eve sinned, as the first sin in the human race, it was not by an abstract exercise of will. You can establish from the very data provided for us in Genesis 3 that there was a change of disposition, and it was by that change of disposition or attitude that she acceded to the tempter's allegation and to the tempter's temptation. Nothing can make a man will against immanent disposition of heart and mind. Such a supposition would amount to a violation of the nature with which we are endowed. Nothing can make a man will against the immanent determining disposition of heart and mind. Now, this is not to say, this is not to deny that influences brought to bear upon man for good or for evil power of choosing between two alternatives, one of which is bad and the other of which is good, and that not relatively understood, but absolutely in terms of God's judgment. Now, in dealing with this proposition, first of all, we have to take account of what it does not mean. Does not mean, and I have found in Reformed circles a great deal of confusion on this particular point. Well, various things it does not mean. First, it does not mean that there are no situations in which man had or has the power of contrary choice. Adam, in his state of integrity, had the power of contrary choice. And to deny that would mean that sin was a necessity of his nature. Adam did sin, but we must maintain that he was able not to sin, and able not to sin because he was created upright and holy. Again, regenerate man has the power of contrary choice, the ability to good in virtue of the holiness implanted in regeneration, and the ability to sin because of remaining indwelling sin. And you remember how the Apostle Paul states that very clearly in Romans 7:25. I myself with the mind serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin. So you see, the regenerate man has the power of contrary choice. Contrary choice in terms of the antithesis between that which is good and good in the sight of God and that which is evil. Now, second, that this proposition is not concerned with something else. It does not mean that fallen, unregenerate man is destitute of the power of alternative choice. The unregenerate man is under an unholy necessity of sinning. He cannot but sin. He is totally depraved. He cannot choose what is good and well-pleasing to God. For the mind of the flesh is enmity against God, is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can it be. But within the realm of bondage to sin, there are numberless alternatives from which he is able to choose. Likewise, regenerate man cannot will certain things because of his confirmed state of holiness. You find that in 1 John 3:9. That which is born of God does not do sin. He cannot sin because he is begotten of God. So there are many situations, there are many things with respect to which the regenerate man cannot be guilty. For example, he cannot apostatize from the faith. He is kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation. But, nevertheless, there are many situations in which he has alternative choice in the categories of both good and evil. That is, the regenerate man. Alternatives of good, because he is regenerated, and alternatives of evil, because he has still indwelling sin. And then third, what this proposition does not mean, this proposition is not dealing with the determinism arising from foreordination. Now it is here that I find a great many people under misunderstanding respecting the Augustinian proposition, passed on, of course, to Calvinism, that the power of contrary choice is not of the essence of free agency. This is not dealing with the determinism of foreordination. It is true that all our choices and acts are foreordained, and only foreordained acts come to pass. But that is not the factor or consideration contemplated in the proposition. And it never was the factor contemplated in the proposition in the Augustinian tradition. To suppose that it is the factor is to confuse two things that must be kept distinct. Now, if it were the determinant, now this is not to say, this is not to deny that influences brought to bear upon man for good or for evil, influences of suasion to good or of temptation to evil, are not real and are not very influential. The consideration is simply that the person must come to acquiesce in that which the solicitation involves. The disposition of the person is affected not by compulsion, but by acquiescence or adoption or acceptance. So freedom is defined negatively and affirmatively. Negatively as the absence of compulsion and self-determination respectively. Negatively, the absence of compulsion, and positively in terms of self-determination. A man is responsible for his acts because they are due to his volition. He is responsible for his volitions because they are self-propelled, exercised without compulsion, and expressive of what he is in the innermost bent, bias, and disposition of heart and mind. And understood thus, freedom could be called rational spontaneity. Now sixth main observation is the inclusiveness of freedom, of this freedom of which I've been speaking. It is not restricted to the sphere of volition and action. It applies to the heart, to the dispositional complex itself. The heart of man is his own. Man is depraved, but this depravity is his, and he is responsible for it. In the fall, the disposition of man became unholy. So great mystery surrounds that change, and we are never able to solve the mystery of that transition. Yet, the unholy disposition was his, and for all its movements, our first parents were responsible. In regeneration, God gives a new heart, a new disposition of complex, but once again, it belongs to the person regenerated, and although it is efficaciously imparted, it is not a disposition compulsively imposed, so that the new disposition, it is not compulsively imposed, and therefore the new disposition does not violate that which is most characteristically his. In other words, whatever the immanent disposition is, it is his with consent and not by compulsion, contrary to his dispositional complex. Now the seventh main caption with which I try to summarize this topic, number seven, is the analysis of the proposition that the power of contrary choice is not of the essence of free agency. The power of contrary choice is not of the essence of free agency. And of course, on that proposition, a great deal of the debate in the history of thought going way back to the early centuries turns. In dealing with the proposition, it is necessary to distinguish between contrary choice and alternative choice. That has not always been done, but I think it is necessary for proper analysis. Contrary choice is the ability to choose between alternatives that are morally antithetical, between good and bad, regarded not relatively, but absolutely in terms of God's judgment. Whereas alternative choice, on the other hand, is the choice between alternatives that are ethically of the same character. Alternatives that are both good or both bad. The proposition applies only to contrary choice. And it is necessary to bear that in mind. It is not concerned with the power of alternative choice within the same ethical orbit, but the power of contrary choice, the power of choosing between two alternatives, one of which is bad and the other of which is good, and that not relatively understood, but absolutely in terms of God's judgment. Now, in dealing with this proposition, first of all, we have to take account of what it does not mean. Does not mean, and I have found in Reformed circles a great deal of confusion on this particular point. Well, various things it does not mean. First, it does not mean that there are no situations in which man had or has the power of contrary choice. Adam, in his state of integrity, had the power of contrary choice. And to deny that would mean that sin was a necessity of his nature. Adam did sin, but we must maintain that he was able not to sin. And able not to sin because he was created upright and holy. Again, regenerate man has the power of contrary choice, the ability to good in virtue of the holiness implanted in regeneration, and the ability to sin because of remaining indwelling sin. And you remember how the Apostle Paul states that very clearly in Romans 7:25. I myself with the mind serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin. So you see, the regenerate man has the power of contrary choice. Contrary choice in terms of the antithesis between that which is good and good in the sight of God and that which is evil. Now, second, this proposition is not concerned with something else. It does not mean that fallen, unregenerate man is destitute of the power of alternative choice. The unregenerate man is under an unholy necessity of sinning. He cannot but sin. He is totally depraved. He cannot choose what is good and well-pleasing to God. For the mind of the flesh is enmity against God, is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can it be. But within the realm of bondage to sin, there are numberless alternatives from which he is able to choose. Likewise, regenerate man cannot will certain things because of his confirmed state of holiness. You find that in 1 John 3:9. That which is born of God does not do sin. He cannot sin because he is begotten of God. So there are many situations, there are many things with respect to which the regenerate man cannot be guilty. For example, he cannot apostatize from the faith. He is kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation. But, nevertheless, there are many situations in which he has alternative choice in the categories of both good and evil. That is the regenerate man. Alternatives of good because he is regenerated, and alternatives of evil because he has still an indwelling sin. And then third, what this proposition does not mean. This proposition is not dealing with the determinism arising from foreordination. Now it is here that I find a great many people under misunderstanding respecting the Augustinian proposition, passed on, of course, to Calvinism, that the power of contrary choice is not of the essence of free agency. It is not dealing with the determinism of foreordination. It is true that all our choices and acts are foreordained, and only foreordained acts come to pass. But that is not the factor or consideration contemplated in the proposition. And it never was the factor contemplated in the proposition in the Augustinian tradition. To suppose that it is the factor is to confuse two things that must be kept distinct. Now, if it were the determinism arising from the foreordination of God, then the power of both alternative and contrary choice would be entirely eliminated from the realm of human agency and possibility. Power of contrary choice would not be predicable of Adam in his state of integrity. Now that is a position that must be resisted, and resisted without any equivocation. We are bound to say that the power of contrary choice belonged to him in his original state. The distinction, therefore, is to be borne in mind. This distinction is to be borne in mind, that foreordination, so all-inclusive, does not operate so as to deprive man of his agency, nor of the voluntary decision by reason of which he is responsible for his action. Similarly, foreordination does not rule out the power of contrary choice in those cases where this obtained in the past or obtains still. Just as foreordination does not conflict with or rule out human responsibility, so it does not conflict with or rule out the power of alternative choice, nor does it conflict with or rule out the power of contrary choice, where that power is necessarily positive. Now, what is the point of the proposition? Now, more positively, the proposition is concerned solely with the truth that in a state of confirmed holiness or confirmed unholiness, the absence of the power to the contrary, the absence of the power to choose the morally opposite, does not interfere with free agency. In the state of sin, unregenerate, we are unable to love God and choose what is well-pleasing to him. That inability is total, but it does not deprive us of free agency in the sense in which it needs to be defined. In fact, it is only in virtue of free agency that the indictment of bondage to sin, or the characterization total depravity could apply. Likewise, in the regenerate state, and particularly in the glorified state, the holy necessity of doing good and the impossibility of the opposite does not interfere with free agency. So again, it is the fact of free agency that makes the characterization possible and relevant, namely the impossibility of the opposite. The proposition, therefore, respects moral and religious condition exclusively and has reference to the necessities belonging to a condition of confirmed goodness or confirmed badness, not to the necessity arising from God's foreordination. Every proposition, we must remember, has its own universe of reference and is applicable only within that universe. The anthropological importance of this particular proposition appears particularly in three connections. First, the prelapsarian power of contrary choice was not a necessary condition of free agency. I say that again. The prelapsarian, that is, the pre-fall power of contrary choice belonging to our first parents, was not a necessary condition of free agency. If Adam had, by a simple act of grace, been confirmed in his integrity, he would still be a free agent. If he had been confirmed in his integrity by an act of sheer grace comparable to the act of free grace in regeneration, I say simply comparable to an act of free grace in regeneration, that would not in any way interfere with his free agency. The power of contrary choice was for the purposes of probation, not for the purpose of reserving for man his true nature as man. Then second, total inability for good in the state of sin does not rule out free agency. Inability for good is one thing, responsible agency is something entirely different. Then third, in grace, relatively, and in glory completely, confirmation in holiness does not make us automata. It is in such confirmation in reality that free agency achieves its highest expression and realization. So, the essence of free agency is that we act without compulsion from without, according to our nature or character. Free agency thus construed applies to all conditions of men and angels, good or bad. Now the final proposition, connection with this subject of free agency, is that free agency is consistent with certainty. That is, with certainty of occurrence. The principle here asserted is that an act may be certain as to its futurition and free as to the mode of its occurrence. The proposition goes athwart every position which supposes that uncertainty or contingency is necessary to freedom, that certainty of occurrence is incompatible with the nature of a free act. Now that position that certainty of occurrence is incompatible with the nature of a free act is analogous to that which would deny foreordination in favor of human responsibility. And the answer to that erroneous position is simply that although we are not able to analyze the relations of God's foreordination to a human agency, that we are not able to perceive the perfect conjunction of these two, nevertheless, we must maintain that there is perfect compatibility, perfect consistency, what might be called in the language of theology a perfect concursus of foreordination and human responsibility. We must maintain both without any infringement upon the province, reality, and integrity of each. That is, foreordination and certainty arising therefrom on the one hand, and free agency on the other. The foreknowledge of God presupposes certainty of occurrence. Foreordination renders all occurrence certain. And by God's providence, what is foreordained is unalterably put into effect. Only within the realm of all-inclusive providence is our free agency a fact, and only thus is it maintained. In God we live and move and have our being. Providence, in fulfillment of foreordained purpose, is not only compatible with the freedom belonging to our being, it is indispensable to the existence of our freedom, and never functions so as to interfere with it. Thank you.